Oh, if you do know him, cried Julie, can you tell us where he is, where we can find him? Maximilian, Emmanuel, if we do but discover him, he must believe in the gratitude of the heart. Monte Cristo felt tears start into his eyes, and he again walked hastily up and down the room. In the name of heaven, said Maximilian, if you know anything of him, tell us what it is. Alas, replied Monte Cristo, striving to repress his emotion, if Lord Wilmore was your unknown benefactor, I fear you will never again see him. I parted from him 2 years ago at Palermo, and he was then on the point of setting out for the most remote regions, so that I fear he will never return. Oh, monsieur, this is cruel of you, said Julie, much affected, and the young lady's eyes swam with tears. Madame, replied Monte Cristo gravely, and gazing earnestly on the two liquid pearls that trickled down Julie's cheeks, had Lord Wilmore seen what I now see, he would become attached to life, for the tears you shed would reconcile him to mankind. And he held out his hand to Julie, who gave him hers, carried away by the look and accent of the Count. But, continued she, Lord Wilmore had a family or friends. He must have known someone. Can we not? Oh, it is useless to inquire, returned the Count. He was not the man you seek, for he was my friend. He had no secrets from me, and he would have confided this also to me. And he told you nothing? Not a word. And yet you instantly named him. Ah, in such a case one supposes sister, sister, said Maximilian, coming to the Count's aid. Monsieur is quite right. Recollect what our excellent father so often told us. It was no Englishman that thus saved us. Monte Cristo started. What did your father tell you, Monsieur Morel? Said he eagerly. My father thought that this action had been miraculously performed. He believed that a benefactor had arisen from the grave to serve us. Oh, it was a touching superstition, monsieur, and although I did not myself believe it, I would not for the world have destroyed my father's faith in it. How often did he muse over it, and pronounce the name of a friend lost to him for ever. And on his deathbed, when the near approach of eternity seemed to have illumined his mind with supernatural light, this thought, which had until then been but a doubt, became a conviction, and his last words were, Maximilian, it was Edmond Dantès. At these words, the Count's paleness, which had for some time been increasing, became alarming. He could not speak. He looked at his watch like a man who had forgotten the time, said a few hurried words to Madame Urbeau, and pressing the hands of Emmanuel and Maximilian, Madame, said he, I trust you will allow me to visit you from time to time. I value your friendship and feel grateful to you for your welcome, for this is the first time for many years that I have thus yielded to my feelings. And he hastily quitted the apartment. This Count of Monte Cristo is a singular man, said Emmanuel. Yes, answered Maximilian, but I feel sure he has an excellent heart and that he likes us. His voice went to my heart, observed Julie, and two or three times I fancied I had heard it before. 52. Pyramus and Thisbe. About the centre of the Faubourg Saint-Honoré, and at the back of one of the most distinguished-looking mansions in this rich neighbourhood, where the various hotels vie with each other for elegance of design and magnificence of construction, extended a large garden, whose widely spreading chestnut trees raised their heads above the walls high and solid as those of a rampart, scattering each spring a shower of delicate pink and white blossoms into the large stone vases placed at equal distances upon the two square pilasters supporting an iron gate, curiously wrought after the style and manner of the reign of Louis XIV. This noble entrance, however, in spite of its striking appearance and the graceful effect of the geraniums planted in the two vases as they waved their variegated leaves in the wind and charmed the eye with their scarlet bloom, had fallen into utter disuse from the period when the proprietors of the hotel, and many years had elapsed since then, had confined themselves to the possession of the hotel with its thickly planted courtyard opening into the Faubourg Saint-Honoré, and the garden shut in by this gate, which formerly communicated with a fine kitchen garden of about an acre in extent. But the demon of speculation, having drawn a line, or, in other words, projected a street, at the extremity of this kitchen garden, and even before the foundations of the said street were dug, its name being duly affixed upon an iron plate at the corner of the situation chosen, it occurred to the then possessor of the hotel we are describing that a handsome sum might be obtained for the ground now devoted to fruits and vegetables, for the purpose of adding it to the projected street intended to form a great branch of communication with the Faubourg Saint-Honoré itself, one of the most important thoroughfares in the city of Paris. In matters of speculation, however, though man proposes, yet money disposes. From some such difficulty, the newly named street died almost in birth, and the purchaser of the kitchen garden, having paid a high price for it, and being quite unable to find anyone willing to take his bargain off his hands without a considerable loss, yet still clinging to the belief that at some future day he should obtain a sum for it that would repay him not only for his past outlay, but also the interest upon the capital locked up in his new acquisition, contented himself with letting the ground temporarily to some market gardeners at a yearly rent of 500 francs. Thus, then, as already stated, the iron gate leading into the kitchen garden had been closed up and left to the rust, which bade fair to destroy its hinges ere long, while to prevent the ignoble glances of the diggers and delvers of the ground from presuming to sully the aristocratical enclosure belonging to the hotel, the gate in question had been boarded up to a height of 6 feet. True, the planks were not so closely adjusted but that a hasty peep might be obtained between the interstices, but the strict decorum and rigid propriety of the inhabitants of the hotel left no grounds for apprehending that advantage would be taken of that circumstance. Horticulture seemed, however, to have been abandoned in the deserted kitchen garden, and where the most choice and delicate of fruits and vegetables once reared their heads, a scanty crop of lucerne alone bore evidence of its being deemed worthy of cultivation. A small, low door gave egress from the walled space we have been describing into the projected street, the ground having been abandoned as unproductive by its various renters, and had now fallen so completely in general estimation as to return not even a fraction of the poor 10 shillings per cent it had originally paid. Towards the hotel, the chestnut trees we have before mentioned rose high above the wall, without in any way affecting the growth of other luxuriant shrubs and flowers that eagerly pressed forward to fill up the vacant spaces, as though asserting their right to enjoy the boon of light and air also. At one corner, where the foliage became so thick as almost to shut out day, a large stone bench and sundry rustic seats indicated that this sheltered spot was either in general favour or particular use by some inhabitant of the hotel, which was faintly discernible through the dense mass of verdure that partially concealed it, though situated but 100 paces off. Whoever had selected this retired portion of the grounds as the boundary of their walks or scene of their meditative musings was abundantly justified in their choice by the absence of all glare, the cool refreshing shade, the screen it afforded from the scorching rays of the sun that found no entrance there even during the burning days of hottest summer, the incessant and melodious warbling of birds, and the entire removal from either the noise of the street or the bustle of the hotel. On the evening of one of the warmest days spring had yet bestowed on the inhabitants of Paris, might be seen, negligently thrown upon the stone bench, a book, a parasol, or a work-basket, from which hung a partly embroidered cambric handkerchief, while at a little distance from these articles was a young female standing close to the iron gate, endeavouring to discern something on the other side by means of the openings in the planks, whilst the earnestness of her attitude and the fixed gaze with which she seemed to seek the object of her wishes proved how much her feelings were interested in the matter. At that instant, the little side door leading from the waste ground to the street was noiselessly opened, and a tall, powerful young man, dressed in a common grey blouse and velvet cap, but whose carefully arranged hair, beard and moustaches, all of the richest and glossiest black, ill accorded with his plebeian attire, and after casting a rapid glance around him, in order to assure himself he was unobserved, entered by this door, and carefully closing and securing it after him, proceeded with a hurried step towards the iron gate. At the sight of him she expected, though probably not under such a costume, the female we have before mentioned started in terror and was about to make a hasty retreat. But the eye of love had already seen the movement of the white robe and observed the fluttering of the blue sash fastened around the slender waist of his fair neighbour. Pressing his lips close to the envious planks that prevented his further progress, he exclaimed, "Fear nothing, Valentine, it is I." Again the timid girl found courage to return to the gate, saying as she did so, "And wherefore come you so late today? It is almost the dinner hour, and I have been compelled to exercise my utmost skill to get rid of the incessant watchfulness of my stepmother, as well as the espionage of my maid, who, no doubt, is employed to report all I do and say. Nor has it cost me a little trouble to free myself from the troublesome society of my brother, under pretense of coming hither to work undisturbed at my embroidery, which, by the way, I am in no hurry to finish. So pray excuse yourself as well as you can for having made me wait, and after that, tell me why I see you in so singular a dress that at first I did not recognize you." "Dearest Valentine," said the young man, "the difference between our respective stations makes me fear to offend you by speaking of my love. But yet I cannot find myself in your presence without longing to pour forth my soul and to tell you how fondly I adore you. If it be but to carry away with me the recollection of such sweet moments, I could even bless, thank you for chiding me, for it leaves me a gleam of hope that, if not expecting me, and that indeed would be worse than vanity of me to suppose, at least I was in your thoughts. You ask me the cause of my being late, as also why I come thus disguised. I will candidly explain the reason of both, and I trust to your goodness to pardon me. But first, let me tell you, I have chosen a trade."
"A trade? Oh, Maximilian, how can you jest at a time when we have such deep cause for uneasiness?
Heaven keep me from jesting with that which is far dearer to me than life itself. But listen to me, Valentine, and I will tell you all about it. Tired out with ranging fields and scaling walls, and seriously alarmed at the idea suggested by yourself, that if caught hovering about here, your father would very likely have me sent to prison as a thief, a sort of thing not very desirable for an officer in the French army, whose continual presence in a place where no warlike projects could be supposed to account for it might well create surprise. So, from a captain of Spahi, I have become a gardener, and consequently adopted the costume of my calling."
"What excessive nonsense you talk, Maximilian."
"Nonsense? Pray do not call what I consider the wisest action of my life by such a name. Consider, by becoming a gardener, I effectually screen our meetings from all suspicion or danger. I beseech of you, Maximilian, to cease trifling and tell me what you really mean."
"Simply, that having ascertained that the piece of ground on which I stand was to let, I made application for it, was readily accepted by the proprietor, and am now master of this fine crop of lucerne. Think of that, Valentine. There is nothing now to prevent my building myself a little hut on my plantation, and residing not 20 yards from you. Only imagine what happiness that would afford me. I can scarcely contain myself at the bare idea. Such felicity seems above all price, as a thing impossible and unattainable. But would you believe that I purchase all this delight, joy, and happiness, for which I would cheerfully have surrendered 10 years of my life, at the small cost of 500 francs per annum, paid quarterly? Henceforth, we have nothing to fear. I am on my own ground, and have an undoubted right to place a ladder against the wall and look over when I please, without having any apprehensions of being taken off by the police as a suspicious character. I may also enjoy the precious privilege of assuring you of my fond, faithful, and unalterable affection whenever you visit your favourite bower. unless indeed it offends your pride to listen to professions of love from the lips of a poor working man clad in a blouse and cap. A faint cry of mingled pleasure and surprise escaped from the lips of Valentine, who almost instantly said, in a saddened tone, as though some envious cloud darkened the joy which illumined her heart, "Alas, no, Maximilian, this must not be for many reasons. We should presume too much on our own strength and, like others perhaps, be led astray by our blind confidence in each other's prudence. How can you, for an instant, entertain so unworthy a thought, dear Valentine? Have I not, from the first blessed hour of our acquaintance, schooled all my words and actions to your sentiments and ideas? And you have, I am sure, the fullest confidence in my honour. When you spoke to me of your experiencing a vague and indefinite sense of coming danger, I placed myself blindly and devotedly at your service, asking no other reward than the pleasure of being useful to you. And have I ever since, by word or look, given you cause or regret for having selected me from the numbers that would willingly have sacrificed their lives for you? You told me, my dear Valentine, that you were engaged to Monsieur d'Epernay, and that your father was resolved upon completing the match, and that from his will there was no appeal, as Monsieur de Villefort was never known to change a determination once formed. I kept in the background as you wished, waiting not the decision of your heart or my own, but hoping Providence would graciously interpose in our behalf and order events in our favour. But what cared I for delays or difficulties, so long as my sweet Valentine confessed she loved me, and accepted my fervent vows of unfailing constancy? Blessed avowal, the very recollection of which can at all times raise me even from despair itself. To hear you repeat those enrapturing words from time to time is all I ask, and to obtain that privilege I would cheerfully endure even double my present disquietudes. Ah, Maximilian, that is the very thing that makes you so bold, and which renders me at once so happy and unhappy, that I frequently ask myself whether it is better for me to endure the harshness of my stepmother and her blind preference for her own child, or to be, as I now am, insensible to my pleasure save such as I find in these our meetings, so fraught with danger to both. I will not admit that word, returned the young man. It is at once cruel and unjust. Is it possible to find a more submissive slave than myself? You have permitted me to converse with you from time to time, Valentine, but forbidden my ever following you in your walks or elsewhere. Have I not obeyed? And since I found means to enter this enclosure to exchange a few words with you through this door, to be close to you without being enabled to obtain a view of your dear features, have I even solicited to touch the tip of your glove through the small openings of the palisades? Think you that at my age and with my strength this wall that now parts us would keep me from your side one instant, were it not that my respect for your wishes presents an impassable barrier? Never has a complaint or a murmur of your rigour escaped me. I have been bound by my promises as rigidly as any knight of olden times. Come, come, dearest Valentine, confess that what I say is true, lest I be tempted to call you unjust. It is indeed most true, said Valentine, as she passed the end of her slender fingers through a small opening in the planks, thus permitting her lover to press his lips to the taper fingers that almost instantly disappeared. And you are a true and faithful friend. But still, you acted from motives of self-interest, my dear Maximilian, for you well knew that from the moment in which you had manifested an opposite spirit, all would have been ended between us. You promised to bestow on me the friendly affection of a brother. I, who have no friend but yourself upon earth, who am neglected and forgotten by my father, harassed and persecuted by my stepmother, and left to the sole companionship of a paralyzed and speechless old man, whose withered hand can no longer press mine, and whose eye alone converses with me, while doubtless, however fixed, chilled his frame, there still lingers in his heart the warmest tenderness for his poor grandchild. Oh, how bitter a fate is mine, to serve either as a victim or an enemy to all who are stronger than myself, while my only friend and supporter is but a living corpse. Indeed, Maximilian, I am very miserable, and you are right to love me for myself alone.
Dear Valentine, replied the young man, deeply affected, I will not say you are all I love in the world, for I dearly prize my sister and brother-in-law, but my affection for them is calm and tranquil, in no manner resembling that I feel for you. At the mere thoughts of you, my heart beats more quickly, my blood flows with increased rapidity through my veins, and my breast heaves with tumultuous emotions. But I solemnly promise you to restrain all this ardor, this fervor and intensity of feeling, until you yourself shall require me to render them available in serving or assisting you. Monsieur France is not expected to return home for a year to come, I am told. In that time, many favorable and unforeseen chances may befriend us. Let us then hope for the best. Hope is so sweet a comforter. Meanwhile, Valentine, while reproaching me with selfishness, think a little what you have been to me. The beautiful but cold resemblance of a marble Venus. What promise of future reward have you made me for all the submission and obedience I have evinced? None whatever. What granted me? Scarcely more. You tell me of Monsieur France d'Epernay, your betrothed lover, and you shrink from the idea of being his wife. But tell me, Valentine, is there no other sorrow in your heart? You see me devoted to you body and soul. My life and each warm drop that circles round my heart are consecrated to your service. You know full well that my existence is bound up in yours, that were I to lose you, I would not outlive the hour of such crushing misery. Yet you speak with calmness of the prospect of your being the wife of another. Oh, Valentine, were I in your place, and did I feel conscious, as you do, of being worshipped, adored, with such a love as mine, 100 times at least should I have passed my hand between these iron bars, and said to poor Maximilian, Take this hand, dearest Maximilian, and believe that living or dead I am yours, yours only and for ever. The poor girl made no reply, but her lover could plainly hear her sobs. A rapid change took place in the young man's feelings. "Dearest, dearest Valentine," exclaimed he, "forgive me if I have offended you, and forget the words I spoke if they have unwittingly caused you pain." "No, Maximilian, I am not offended," answered she. "But do you not see what a poor, helpless being I am, almost a stranger and an outcast in my father's house, where even he is seldom seen, whose will has been thwarted and spirits broken from the age of 10 years beneath the iron rod so sternly exercised over me? Oppressed, mortified, and persecuted, day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute, no person has cared for, even observed my sufferings, nor have I ever breathed one word on the subject, save to yourself. Outwardly, and in the eyes of the world, I am surrounded by kindness and affection, but the reverse is the case. The general remark is, Oh, it cannot be expected that one of so stern a character as Monsieur de Villefort could lavish the tenderness some fathers do on their daughters. What, though she has lost her own mother at a tender age, she has had the happiness to find a second mother in Madame de Villefort. The world, however, is mistaken. My father abandons me from utter indifference, while my stepmother detests me with a hatred so much the more terrible as it is veiled beneath a continual smile.
"Hate you, sweet Valentine?" exclaimed the young man. "How is it possible for anyone to do that?" "Alas," replied the weeping girl, "I am obliged to own that my stepmother's aversion to me arises from a very natural source. Her overweening love for her own child, my brother Edouard. But why should it? Nay, I know not. But, though unwilling to introduce money matters into our present conversation, I will just say this much, that her extreme dislike to me has its origin in mercenary motives, and I much fear she envies me the fortune I already enjoy in right of my mother, and which will be more than doubled at the death of Monsieur and Madame de Saint-Marin, whose sole heiress I am. Madame de Villefort has nothing of her own, and hates me for being so richly endowed. Alas, how gladly would I exchange the half of this wealth for the happiness of at least sharing my father's love. God knows, I would prefer sacrificing the whole, so that it would obtain me a happy and affectionate home."
"Poor Valentine!"
I seemed to myself as though living a life of bondage, yet at the same time am so conscious of my own weakness that I fear to break the restraint in which I am held, lest I fall utterly powerless and helpless. Then, too, my father is not a person whose orders may be infringed with impunity. Protected as he is by his high position and firmly established reputation for talent and unswerving integrity, no one could oppose him. He is all-powerful with even his king. You he would crush at a word, and myself he would cause to expire of terror at his feet. Dear Maximilian, believe me when I assure you that I attempt not to resist my father's commands, more on your account than my own, for though I could willingly sacrifice myself, I would not peril your safety. But wherefore, my sweet Valentine, do you persist in anticipating the worst, and in viewing everything through so gloomy a medium? Why picture the future so fraught with evil? Because I judge it from the past. Still, consider that, although I may not be, strictly speaking, what is termed an illustrious match for you, I am for many reasons not altogether so much beneath your alliance. The days when such distinctions were so nicely weighed and considered no longer exist in France, and the first families of the monarchy have intermarried with those of the empire. The aristocracy of the lance has allied itself with the nobility of the cannon. Now, I belong to this last-named class, and certainly my prospects of military preferment are most encouraging as well as certain. My fortune, though small, is free and unfettered, and the memory of my late father, respected in our country, Valentine, as that of the most upright and honourable merchant of the city. I say our country, because you were born not far from Marseille. Name not Marseille, I beseech you, Maximilian. That one word brings back my mother to my recollection, my angel mother, who died too soon for myself and all who knew her, but who, after watching over her child during the brief period allotted to her in this world, now, I fondly hope and fully believe, contemplates her with pitying tenderness from those realms of bliss to which her pure spirit has flown. Ah, were she still living, we need fear nothing, Maximilian, for I would confide our love to her, and she would aid and protect us. I fear, Valentine, replied the lover, that were she living, I should never have had the happiness of knowing you. You would then have been too happy to have stooped from your grandeur to bestow a thought on a humble, obscure individual like myself. It is you who are unkind, aye, and unjust too, now, Maximilian, cried Valentine. But there is one thing I wish to know. And what is that? Inquired the young man, perceiving that Valentine hesitated and seemed at a loss how to proceed. Tell me, truly, Maximilian, whether in former days when our fathers dwelt at Marseille, there ever existed any misunderstanding between them? Not that I am at all aware of, replied the young man, unless indeed any ill feeling might have arisen from their being of opposite parties, your father being, as you know, a zealous partisan of the Bourbons, while mine was wholly devoted to the Emperor. There could not possibly be any other difference between them. But now that I have answered your question to the best of my power and knowledge, tell me, dearest, why you ask. I will, replied his fair companion, for it is but right you should know all. Then I must begin by referring to the day when your being made an officer of the Legion of Honour was publicly announced in the papers. We were all sitting in the apartments of my grandfather, Monsieur Noirtier. Monsieur Danglars was there also. You recollect Monsieur Danglars, do you not, Maximilian, the banker, whose horses ran away with my stepmother and little brother and very nearly killed them? While the rest of the company were discussing the approaching marriage of Mademoiselle Danglars, I was occupied in reading the paper aloud to my grandfather. But when I came to the paragraph concerning you, although I had done nothing else but read it over to myself all the morning, you know you had told me all about it the previous evening, I felt so happy and yet so nervous at the idea of pronouncing your beloved name aloud and before so many people, that I really think I should have passed it over, but for the fear that my so doing might create suspicions as to the cause of my silence. So I summoned up all my courage and read it as firmly and steadily as I could. Dear Valentine, well, would you believe it? Directly my father caught the sound of your name, he turned round quite hastily, and like a poor silly thing, I was so persuaded that everyone must be as much affected as myself by the utterance of your name, that I was not surprised to see my father start and almost tremble. But I even thought, though that surely must have been a mistake, that Monsieur Danglars underwent a similar emotion. Morrel? Morrel? Cried my father. Stop a bit. Then, knitting his brows into a deep frown, he added, "Surely this cannot be one of the Morrel family who lived at Marseilles and gave us so much trouble from their being such violent Bonapartists. I mean about the year 1815. "I fancy," replied Monsieur Danglars, "that the individual alluded to in the journal Mademoiselle is reading is the son of the large shipowner there." "Indeed," answered Maximilian. "And what said your father then, Valentine? Oh, such a dreadful thing, I dare not repeat it. Nay, dearest," said the young man, "be not afraid to tell me. Say, what was it?" "Ah," continued my father, still frowning severely, "their idolized emperor treated these madmen as they deserved. He called them food for cannon, which was precisely all they were good for. And I am delighted to see the present government have adopted this salutary principle with all its pristine vigour. If Algiers were good for nothing but to furnish out the means of carrying so admirable an idea into practice, it would be an acquisition well worthy of struggling to obtain, though it certainly does cost France somewhat dear to assert its rights in that uncivilized country." "The sentiments expressed were somewhat unfeeling, I must confess," said Maximilian. "But do not let that tinge your fair cheek with the blush of shame, my gentle Valentine. For I can assure you that, although in a different way, my father was not a jot or tittle behind yours in the heat of his political expressions. Why," said he, "does not the emperor, who has devised so many clever and efficient modes of improving the art of war, not form a regiment of lawyers, judges, and legal practitioners, sending them in the hottest fire the enemy could maintain, and using them to save better men? You see, my sweet Valentine, that for mildness of expression and imaginative benefits, there is not much to choose between the language of either royalist or Bonapartist." "But what said Monsieur Danglars to this burst of party spirit on the part of the Procureur du Roi?" "Oh, he laughed, and in that singular manner so peculiar to himself, half malicious, half ferocious. His smile even has always made me shudder, it has so very unnatural a look. He almost immediately rose and took his leave. Then, for the first time, I observed the agitation of my grandfather, and I must tell you, Maximilian, that I am the only person capable of discerning emotion in the paralyzed frame of my poor afflicted relative. And I suspected that the conversation that had been carried on in his presence, for no one ever cares to refrain from saying and doing what they like before the dear old man without the smallest regard to his feelings, had made a strong impression on his mind. For, naturally enough, it must have pained him to hear the emperor he so devotedly loved and served spoken of in that depreciating manner." "The name of Monsieur Noirtier," interposed Maximilian, "is celebrated throughout Europe. He was a statesman of high standing, and I know not whether you are aware, Valentine, that he took a leading part in every Bonapartian conspiracy set on foot during the restoration of the Bourbons. Oh, I have often heard whispers of things that seem to me most strange. The father a Bonapartist, the son a royalist. What can have been the reason of so singular a difference in parties and politics? But to resume my story, I turned towards my grandfather as though to question him as to the cause of his emotion. He looked expressively at the newspaper I had been reading. 'What is the matter, dear grandfather?' said I. 'Are you pleased?' He gave me a sign in the affirmative. 'With what my father said just now?' He returned a sign in the negative. Perhaps you liked what Monsieur Danglars remarked. Another sign in the negative. Oh, then, you were glad to hear that Monsieur Morel, I durst not pronounce the dear name of Maximilian, had been made an officer of the Legion of Honour. Was that it, dear grandpapa? He signified assent in a way that convinced me he was more than glad, that he was delighted. Only think of the poor old man's being so pleased to think that you, who were a perfect stranger to him, had been made an officer of the Legion of Honour. Perhaps, though, it was a mere whim on his part, for he is almost falling into a second childhood. But for all that, I love him dearly, and pray that he may long be spared to me. How singular, murmured Maximilian, that your father should apparently hate the very mention of my name, while your grandfather, on the contrary... Well, well, it is no use to endeavour to find a reason for these things. Strange indeed are the feelings brought into play by the action of party likes or dislikes. Hush! Cried Valentine suddenly. Conceal yourself. Go, go, someone comes. Maximilian leaped at one bound into his crop of lucerne, which he commenced pulling up in the most pitiless manner, under the pretext of being occupied in weeding it. Mademoiselle! Mademoiselle! Exclaimed a voice from behind the trees. Madame is searching for you everywhere. There are visitors in the drawing-room.
Who is it? Inquired Valentine, much agitated.
Are they ladies?
Oh, no, mademoiselle. I believe it is some grand prince, or a duke, or a king, perhaps. Stay, now I remember. They said he was the Count of Monte Cristo, and that he wished particularly to see you.
I will come directly, said Valentine aloud.
The name caused an electric shock to the individual on the other side of the iron gate, on whose ear the I will come of Valentine sounded the usual parting knell of all their interviews. Now then, said Maximilian, as tired with his unusual employment, he stopped to rest himself by leaning on the handle of a spade he had taken care to furnish himself with. Would I give much to know how it comes about that the Count of Monte Cristo is acquainted with Monsieur de Villefort? 53. Toxicology. It was really the Count of Monte Cristo who had just arrived at Madame de Villefort's for the purpose of returning the visit of the Procureur du Roi, and at this name, as may be easily imagined, the whole house was in confusion. Madame de Villefort, who was alone in her drawing-room when the Count was announced, desired that her son might be brought thither instantly to renew his thanks to the Count, and Edouard, who heard nothing and nobody talked of for two whole days but this great personage, made all possible haste to come to him, not from obedience to his mother, not from any feeling of gratitude to the Count, but from sheer curiosity, and that he might make some remark, by help of which he might find an opportunity for saying one of those small pertnesses which made his mother say, "Oh, that sad child, but pray excuse him, he is really so clever." After the first unusual civilities, the Count inquired after Monsieur de Villefort.
"My husband dines with the Chancellor," replied the young wife. "He has just gone, and I'm sure he'll be exceedingly sorry not to have had the pleasure of seeing you before he went."
Two visitors who were there when the Count arrived, having gazed at him with all their eyes, retired after that reasonable delay which politeness admits and curiosity requires.
"Ah, what is your sister Valentine doing?" inquired Madame de Villefort of Edouard. "Tell someone to bid her come here, that I may have the honour of introducing her to the Count."
"You have a daughter, then, madame?" inquired the Count. "Very young, I presume."
"The daughter of Monsieur de Villefort," replied the young wife, "by his first marriage. A fine, well-grown girl."
"But melancholy," interrupted Master Edouard, snatching the feathers out of the tail of a splendid paroquet that was screaming on its gilded perch, in order to make a plume for his hat. Madame de Villefort merely cried, "Silence, Edouard." She then added,
This young madcap is, however, very nearly right, and merely re-echoes what he has heard me say with pain 100 times, for Mademoiselle de Villefort is, in spite of all we can do to rouse her, of a melancholy disposition and taciturn habit, which frequently injure the effect of her beauty. But what detains her? Go, Edouard, and see.
Because they are looking for her where she is not to be found.
And where are they looking for her? With Grandpapa Noirtier. And do you think she is not there?
No, 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 no. She is not there, replied Edouard, singing his words.
And where is she, then? If you know, why don't you tell?
She is under the great chestnut tree, replied the spoiled brat, as he gave, in spite of his mother's cries, live flies to the parrot, who appeared to relish such small deer exclusively. Madame de Villefort stretched out her hand to ring, intending to direct her waiting-maid to the spot where she would find Valentine, when the young lady herself entered the apartment. She appeared much dejected, and any person who considered her attentively might have observed the traces of recent tears in her eyes. Valentine, whom we have in the rapid march of our narrative presented to our readers, without formally introducing her, was a tall and graceful girl of 19 years of age, with bright chestnut hair, deep blue eyes, and that languishing air so full of distinction which characterized her mother. Her white and slender fingers, her pearly neck, her cheeks tinted with varying hues, gave her at the first view the aspect of one of these lovely Englishwomen who have been so poetically compared in their manner to a swan admiring itself. She entered the apartment, and seeing near her stepmother, the stranger of whom she had already heard so much, saluted him without any girlish awkwardness or even lowering her eyes, and with an elegance that redoubled the Count's attention. He rose to return the salutation.
"Mademoiselle de Villefort, my stepdaughter," said Madame de Villefort to Monte Cristo, leaning back on her sofa and motioning towards Valentine with her hand. "And Monsieur de Monte Cristo, King of China, Emperor of Cochin China," said the young imp, looking slyly towards his sister.
Madame de Villefort at this really did turn pale, and was very nearly angry with this household plague who answered to the name of Edouard. But the Count, on the contrary, smiled and appeared to look at the boy complacently, which caused the maternal heart to bound again with joy and enthusiasm.
"But, madame," replied the Count, continuing the conversation and looking by turns at Madame de Villefort and Valentine, "have I not already had the honour of meeting yourself and Mademoiselle before? I could not help thinking so just now. The idea came over my mind, and as Mademoiselle entered, the sight of her was an additional ray of light thrown on a confused remembrance. Excuse me the remark."
"I do not think it likely, sir. Mademoiselle de Villefort is not very fond of society, and we very seldom go out," said the lady.
"Then it was not in society that I met with Mademoiselle, or yourself, madame, or this charming little merry boy. Besides, the Parisian world is entirely unknown to me, for, as I believe I told you, I have been in Paris but very few days. No, but perhaps you will permit me to call to mind. Stay." The Count placed his hand on his brow as if to collect his thoughts. "No, it was somewhere away from here. It was, I do not know, but it appears that this recollection is connected with a lovely sky and some religious fête. Mademoiselle was holding flowers in her hand. The interesting boy was chasing a beautiful peacock in a garden, and you, madame, were under the trellis of some arbour. Pray come to my aid, madame. Do not these circumstances bring to your mind some reminiscences?"
"No, indeed," replied Madame de Villefort. "And yet it appears to me, sir, that if I had met you anywhere, the recollection of you must have been imprinted on my memory.
Perhaps Monsieur le Comte saw us in Italy," said Valentine timidly.
"Yes, in Italy. It was in Italy, most probably," replied Monte Cristo.
"You have travelled, then, in Italy, mademoiselle?"
"Yes.
Madame and I were there 2 years ago. The doctors were afraid of my lungs and prescribed the air of Naples. We went by Bologna, Perusa, and Rome.
Ah, yes, true, mademoiselle, exclaimed Monte Cristo, as if this simple indication was sufficient to determine his recollections. It was at Perusa, on the day of the Fête Dieu, in the garden of the Hôtel des Postes, when chance brought us together. You, Madame de Villefort, and your son, I now remember having had the honour of meeting you.
I perfectly well remember Perusa, sir, and the Hôtel des Postes, and the fête to which you allude, said Madame de Villefort. But in vain do I tax my memory, of whose treachery I am ashamed, for I really do not recall to mind that I ever had the pleasure of seeing you before. It is strange, but neither do I recollect meeting with you, observed Valentine, raising her beautiful eyes to the Count.
But I remember it perfectly, interposed the darling Edouard.
I will assist your memory, madame, continued the Count. The day had been burning hot. You were waiting for horses, which were delayed in consequence of the festival. Mademoiselle was walking in the shade of the garden, and your son disappeared in pursuit of the bird.
And I caught it, mamma. Don't you remember? Interposed Edouard. And I pulled three such beautiful feathers out of his tail.
You, madame, remained under the arbour formed by the vine. Do you not remember that whilst you were seated on a stone bench, and whilst, as I told you, Mademoiselle de Villefort and your young son were absent, you conversed for a considerable time with somebody?
Yes. In truth, yes, answered the lady, turning very red. I do remember conversing with an individual wrapped in a long woolen mantle. He was a medical man, I think.
Precisely so, madame. That man was myself. For a fortnight I had been at that hotel, during which period I had cured my valet de chambre of a fever and my landlord of the jaundice, so that I really acquired a reputation as a skilful physician. We discoursed a long time, madame, on different subjects, of Perugino, of Raphael, of manners, customs, of the famous aqua tofana, of which they had told you, I think you said, that certain individuals in Perusa had preserved the secret.
Yes, true, replied Madame de Villefort, with a kind of uneasiness. I remember now.
I do not recollect now all the various subjects of which we discoursed, madame, continued the Count with perfect calmness, but I perfectly remember that, falling into the error which others had entertained respecting me, you consulted me as to the health of Mademoiselle de Villefort.
Yes, really, sir, you were, in fact, a medical man, said Madame de Villefort, since you had cured the sick.
Molière or Beaumarchais would reply to you, madame, that it was precisely because I was not that I had cured my patients. For myself, I am content to say to you that I have studied chemistry and the natural sciences somewhat deeply, but still only as an amateur, you understand. At this moment, the clock struck six.
It is 6 o'clock, said Madame de Villefort, evidently agitated. Valentine, will you not go and see if your grandpapa will have his dinner?
Valentine rose and, saluting the Count, left the apartment without replying a single word.
Oh, madame, said the Count when Valentine had left the room, was it on my account that you sent Mademoiselle de Villefort away?
By no means, replied the lady quickly, but this is the hour when we give to Monsieur Noirtier the sad repast which supports his sad existence. You are aware, sir, of the deplorable condition of my husband's father.
Yes, madame, Monsieur de Villefort spoke of it to me. A paralysis, I think.
Alas, yes. There is an entire want of movement in the frame of the poor old gentleman. The mind alone is still active in this human machine, and that is faint and flickering, like the light of a lamp about to expire. But excuse me, sir, for talking of our domestic misfortunes. I interrupted you at the moment when you were telling me that you were a skilful chemist.
No, madame, I did not say so much as that, replied the Count with a smile. Quite the contrary.
I have studied chemistry because, having determined to live in eastern climates, I have been desirous of following the example of King Mithridates.
Mithridates Rex Ponticus, said the young scamp, as he tore some beautiful portraits out of a splendid album. The individual who breakfasted every morning with a cup of poison à la crème.
Edouard, you naughty boy, exclaimed Madame de Villefort, snatching the mutilated book from the urchin's grasp. You are positively past bearing. You really disturb the conversation. Go, leave us and join your sister Valentine in dear Grandpapa Noirtier's room.
The album, said Edouard sulkily.
What do you mean, the album?
I want the album.
How dare you tear out the drawings?
Oh, it amuses me.
Go. Go directly.
I won't go unless you give me the album, said the boy, seating himself doggedly in an armchair, according to his habit of never giving way.
Take it, then, and pray disturb us no longer, said Madame de Villefort, giving the album to Edouard, who then went towards the door, led by his mother.
The Count followed her with his eyes. Let us see if she shuts the door after him, he muttered. Madame de Villefort closed the door carefully after the child, the Count appearing not to notice her. Then, casting a scrutinizing glance around the chamber, the young wife returned to her chair, in which she seated herself.
"Allow me to observe, madame," said the Count, with that kind tone he could assume so well. "You are really very severe with that dear, clever child."
"Oh, sometimes severity is quite necessary," replied Madame de Villefort, with all a mother's real firmness.
It was his Cornelius Nepos that Master Edouard was repeating when he referred to King Mithridates, continued the Count, and you interrupted him in a quotation, which proves that his tutor has by no means neglected him, for your son is really advanced for his years.
The fact is, Monsieur le Comte, answered the mother, agreeably flattered, he has great aptitude, and learns all that is set before him. He has but one fault. He is somewhat wilful. But really, on referring for the moment to what he said, do you truly believe that Mithridates used these precautions and that these precautions were efficacious?
I think so, madame, because I who now address you, have made use of them that I might not be poisoned at Naples, at Palermo, and at Smyrna, that is to say, in three several occasions of my life, when, but for these precautions, I must have lost my life.
And your precautions were successful?
Completely so.
Yes, I remember now your mentioning to me at Perusa something of this sort.
Indeed, did I? Said the Count, with an air of surprise remarkably well counterfeited.
I really did not remember it.
I inquired of you if poisons acted equally and with the same effect on men of the north as on men of the south, and you answered me that the cold and sluggish habits of the north did not present the same aptitude as the rich and energetic temperaments of the natives of the south.
And that is the case, observed Monte Cristo. I have seen Russians devour, without being visibly inconvenienced, vegetable substances which would infallibly have killed a Neapolitan or an Arab.
And you really believe the result would be still more sure with us than in the East, and in the midst of our fogs and rains, a man would habituate himself more easily than in a warm latitude to this progressive absorption of poison?
Certainly. It being at the same time perfectly understood that he should have been duly fortified against the poison to which he had not been accustomed.
Yes, I understand that.
And how would you habituate yourself, for instance, or rather, how did you habituate yourself to it?
Oh, very easily. Suppose you knew beforehand the poison that would be made use of against you. Suppose the poison was, for instance, brucine.
Brucine is extracted from the Brucia ferruginea, is it not? Inquired Madame de Villefort.
Precisely, madame, replied Monte Cristo. But I perceive I have not much to teach you. Allow me to compliment you on your knowledge. Such learning is very rare amongst ladies.
Oh, I am aware of that, said Madame de Villefort, but I have a passion for the occult sciences, which speak to the imagination like poetry, and are reducible to figures like an algebraic equation. But go on, I pray of you. What you say interests me to the greatest degree.
Well, replied Monte Cristo, suppose then that this poison was brucine, and you were to take a milligram the first day, 2 milligrams the second day, and so on. Well, at the end of 10 days you would have taken a centigram. At the end of 20 days, increasing another milligram, you would have taken 300 centigrams. That is to say, a dose which you would support without inconvenience, and which would be very dangerous for any other person who had not taken the same precautions as yourself. Well, then, at the end of a month, when drinking water from the same carafe, you would kill the person who drank this water as well as yourself, without your perceiving otherwise than from slight inconvenience that there was any poisonous substance mingled with this water.
Do you know any other counterpoison?
I do not.
I have often read and read again the history of Mithridates, said Madame de Villefort in a tone of reflection, and had always considered it as a fable.
No, madame, contrary to most history, it is a truth. But what you tell me, madame, what you inquire of me, is not the result of a chance question. For 2 years since you asked me the same questions, and said, too, that for a very long time this history of Mithridates occupied your mind.
True, sir. The two favourite studies of my youth were botany and mineralogy, and subsequently, when I learned that the use of simples frequently explained the whole history of a people and the entire life of individuals in the East, as flowers betoken and symbolize a love affair, I have regretted I was not a man, that I might have been a Flamel, a Fontana, or a Cabanis.
And the more, madame, said Monte Cristo, as the Orientals do not confine themselves, as did Mithridates, to make a cuirass of his poisons, but they also make them a dagger. Science becomes in their hands not only a defensive weapon, but still more frequently an offensive one. The one serves against all their physical sufferings, the other against all their enemies. With opium, with belladonna, with brucia, snakewood, the cherry laurel, they put to sleep all those who would arouse them. There is not one of those women, Egyptian, Turk, or Greek, whom here you call good women, who do not know how, by means of chemistry, to stupefy a doctor, and in psychology to amaze a confessor.
Really?
Said Madame de Villefort, whose eyes sparkled with strange fire at this conversation.
Eh, indeed, yes, madame, continued Monte Cristo. The secret dramas of the East begin and end thus, from the plant which can create love to the plant that can cause death, from the draught which opens heaven before your eyes to that which plunges a man in hell.
There are as many shades of every kind as there are caprices and peculiarities in human, physical, and moral nature. And I will say further, the art of these chemists knows excellently well how to accommodate and proportion the remedy and the ill to its yearnings of love or its desires for vengeance.
But, sir, remarked the lady, these Eastern societies, in the midst of which you have passed a portion of your existence, are as wild and visionary as the tales that come from their strange land.
A man can easily be put out of the way there, then. It is indeed the Baghdad and Bassorah of Monsieur Galland. The sultans and viziers who rule over such society and who constitute what in France we call the government are, in fact, really these Harun al-Rashids and Giaffas, who not only pardon a poisoner, but even make him a prime minister if his crime has been an ingenious one, and who, under such circumstances, have the whole story written in letters of gold to divert their hours of idleness and ennui.
By no means, madame. The fanciful exists no longer in the East.
They are there now, disguised under other names and concealed under other costumes, agents of police, magistrates, attorney generals, and bailiffs. They hang, behead, and impale their criminals in the most agreeable possible manner. But some of these, like clever rogues, have contrived to escape human justice and succeed in their fraudulent enterprises by cunning stratagems. Amongst us, a simpleton possessed by the demon of hate or cupidity, who has an enemy to destroy or some near relation to dispose of, goes straight to the grocer's or druggist.